Accession number 10295, Reel 4.
Mr. Len, Reel 4. So, your sympathies were with the Arabs, even though you were fighting them?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you read your history, that is, if history is true, what we read, the Jews never, ever lived in that place at all. They were from Egypt. They were kicked out of Egypt. As a matter of fact, if you'll go back in history, even in England, there was a law passed. Oh, now then. I don't know, was it 1700s, 1800s? That Jews are not allowed to reside in England. And that law has never been rescinded. The law is that no Jew is allowed to reside in England, and yet we've got them in Parliament.
Can you tell me any more personal memories from Palestine, things that happened to you and that you witnessed whilst you were there?
Well, the ones I've told you I've witnessed, but no, there's some humorous ones. I mean, our job as infantrymen was, if after skirmish, if it was pointed out that rebels had lived in a certain village or used a certain village, then we had to go in and the powers that be exacted a fine on this village, so that each household had to pay a certain fine, we'll say 50 quid or 20 quid or whatever. And if he couldn't pay the fine, then his house went up in smoke. And on this particular day, we went to a village, and what the spiel was that, or the practice was that, one of the men would have a board, and in English, but pigged in Arabic, if you can understand what I mean, we had to spiel to the Arab what we were there for. We're here to collect a fine for harbouring rebels, you know, etc. So much. Well, one man did the spieling, the other man stood back with his rifle loaded so that he could, you know, stop anyone or anybody acting daft. And on this particular occasion, there was me and a lad called Holroyd, Joe Holroyd. He was from Oldham. He was a laugh-a-day lad, really good.
Laugh-a-day?
A laugh-a-day. He was always full of humour. You never ever found him moaning or, you know, upset. And we went to this particular hut, and it was on the outskirts of the village. And Joe, I don't know, one of us banged on the door with the butt of the rifle. And an old Arab came to the door. And Joe, in his best Arabic, spurted out to him that we're here to collect a fine because he'd been harbouring rebels. And the old man either couldn't understand him or couldn't care bloody less. Slammed the door, went in and slammed the door. So, of course, two rifle butts then on it. And the old man came again and he started to spiel again. And there's a woman shouted from the back. So the old man stepped back and this woman came. And I'm stood back with my rifle and bayonet waiting. And Joe's got his rifle and bayonet and he's got the board. And as he looked up, the woman's got a bloody big wooden spoon. He dropped the board. And there he was running into the sand, into the desert. And this woman after him with a bloody wooden spoon. And it only lasted a few minutes, you know, she just run so far. And as she came back, you could see she was, you know, a bit of a smile on her face. But a big soldier with all that rifle and ammunition, and she'd defeated him with this bloody wooden spoon. We burned her house down. You know, things like that helped to push life through, you know. It was just one of the happy parts of the job, you know. Humorous, you can say, parts of the job. Other than that, most of it was a miserable, monotonous day-to-day routine.
What happened to you in Palestine when war broke out? Were you still there?
No, we left Palestine in October 1938. And we'd just left Palestine and we clambered on the boat in Haifa and was ready for going out. And rumour came down that Hitler had started his campaign in the Middle East. So we was disembarked then onto landing craft. And was sent out. Some went on to the Western Desert. One or two of the lads went as far as Tobruk. I, for my pains, went to Cairo with the band and drums. We was just there waiting to be told what our position would be, you know, if the war came off. Because at that time, that was the time when, what's his name, Chamberlain came back with that piece of paper saying that it, that the war was over, or peace in our time, that's it. So for 4 days, we was stuck in Egypt. And then when, of course, he waved this piece of paper, then we were all brought back and put on the ship, the troop ship, Dilwara. And from there, it was through to Singapore.
When did you go to Singapore?
October. We arrived in Singapore about 5th or the 8th of December, something like that, 1938.
What was the situation there when you got there?
It was peaceful, great, peaceful. I mean, the naval base had only been opened about 12 months previous. That's what makes me call Churchill a bloody liar. Yeah, in all his speeches and memoirs and one thing or another, he says that he had no idea that Singapore was open from the north. And it's bloody stupid because they'd sent pictures, photographs and other things down there to England. He knew what was going on. But he was saying about Singapore when we got there in 1938. It was a bloody big cabaret. By that I mean it was to us anyway. We'd just come out of action. We'd come to relax. And every night you could possibly do it, you could possibly afford it, you went into town. Because it was full of girls, full of booze, it's full of excitement. And it just went on and on. The lights never went out in Singapore, even during the war. Singapore was a great big cabaret. We run out of money. More often than not, we run out of money. The lads themselves, for entertainment, we used to fight. And we'd try and fight enemies if possible. We had, the Gordons were on the north of Singapore. The Manchesters were more or less central and eastern Singapore. The Loyals were in the west of Singapore. And then you had all your ROC, REMC, RSC and stuff like this. We had battalion boxing matches, football matches, cricket matches, where we each... And we, even though we were in different regiments, we knew one another. A lot of us got to know each other. So, for kicks, you'd have a punch-up in the middle of this town. You know, you'd go into a bar, and, I don't know, I suppose, like the kids are doing today, you'd have a few drinks, and then one of the Gordons would call you, you know, a stupid so-and-so. So you'd pick a bottle up and throw it at him, and even it'd miss and hit the wall, shatter. Then the owner of the place would get hysterical. I'm going for the police, you know. So as soon as he started going for the police, somebody'd grab him with a scruff of the neck and sit on him. And then all the lads then would wade in, Loyals, Gordons, Manchesters, and we'd all be having a scrap. Nothing, no knives, no chains, nothing like that. Just a fight. But by the time we'd finished, the place was a wreck, usually. But if it was that the Navy came into town, or as it was on one occasion, the Russians came, then it was bloody murder. You know, as soon as the hint was around that there was a Russian ship in, they didn't come in ones, they came in threes. But as soon as the hint was there that there were Russians in town, they're not going to sleep with our women, they're not going to dance with our girls, you know. And the lads were down there. And the Ruskies were confined to ship. The fighting that went on was just unbelievable. So that's when I got put in clean cats, when we was fighting the Ruskies. Went out and we'd been told that there was possibly going to be a fight at the, I think it was called the Lucky Lady or the Black Cat. There were so many clubs in Singapore, it was just, you know, you couldn't imagine it. But this was out towards Anson Roadway, and I went out there with three of the lads, and was looking for it, you know. And the first club we came across, went in, and it was a shambles. The dance floor was usually about 3 yards by 3 yards square, piece of wood. And when you danced on that. And all round it, the tables and chairs were just scattered and shattered. You know, and the woman who owned it, she was sat there and tears were coming down, you know. And as the tears were coming down, the optics dripping bloody whiskey on it was pathetic.
But the optics are?
The whiskey optics, you know, and the spirit optics. They'd all been broke. And there's dripping spirits coming out, dripping out, you know, and tears are coming down from her face. The floor's got blood on it, you know. And in the background is the record player, which they had in those days. No stereo. So we went in this place, came out, and we thought we'd take a back road out of the place. You know, went round the back. And as we was going up, we could hear the commotion going on. There was a gang of us, don't know how many in it. But we could hear the commotion going on. And as I came out of this passage and hit the light, you know, from the street, it more or less blinded you. And as I came out, somebody grabbed me, you know, put his arms around me. And the worst thing he could have said to me was, "You Preston bastard." But that's what I thought he'd said. But actually he'd said, "You bloody Preston mashers." And that's the worst thing you can say to a Preston lad, calling him a Preston masher.
Why?
That means he's just a bloody tea boy. So what I did, I left out with me the boot. And I could hear his ankle go crap, or his shin. Really cracked him one. And the next thing I know, I'm in the bloody meat wagon. And
but he must have been an Englishman who said that.
It was an MP. It was the MPs that grabbed us. And they collared us, about five of us, I think. And we were put in front of the old man, Eb Holmes, Colonel Holmes. And I could see it staring me in the face. It was definitely 3 months in the cooler. Because that's what most of them got anyway. When it came my turn to go in front of him, what they do, they put you in front of your company commander first, and he refuses to take your case. You're remanded for COs. So you stay in the guard room overnight, and then next morning you go in front of the CO. Well, in that time, the different guards that had been on and different blokes had been on telling me, "Say this, say that, say the other." All the barrack room lawyers, you know. So my plea was that this, what do you call it, this MP had called me a Preston bastard, that was it. And in saying that, he was saying that I belong to the Loyals, and I don't belong to the Loyals. And I don't want anybody getting the idea. But I do. I belong to the Manchesters. I'm proud of it. And I thought this will game up a bit. And he played bloody hell with me. "Don't use that excuse to me. But you're loyal to the regiment. How can you be loyal to the regiment when you go and do things like this? A drummer as well, a top drummer, and you're going out with duty men? Would never be heard of in my time. Because being a drummer or a bandsman, you was a cut above a duty man," or so they thought. You know, and I finished up, I got 14 days CB with an admonishment that I wasn't ever to associate with duty men again. Well, it's bloody hard when you've got 950 men, possibly 1,000 men, and 50 of you are, you know, musicians. You've got to bump into them.
So this was a court-martial, was it?
Oh, no, it's just COs. No, I just got 14 days CB. But at the time, you know, at that time, Singapore was lax. This was before the war broke out.
Was there any special animosity towards the Royal Navy and the Russians then?
Oh, yes. We didn't like the Royal Navy or the Russians. I don't know what it was. I think it was a clash of personalities rather than a clash of individuals. You know, the sailors and the Russians got more money than us. They dressed better than we did. You know, and all this and the other. It was something like that was going through our mind, I think.
What were the Russians like? Were they tough?
No, they were the same as any other doings. They were mostly civilian clothes, but you could tell them. They used to walk out bravado with the necks wide open, you know, the shirt wide open, whereas we always had to wear a collar and tie, you know, a shirt with a tie. But they used to have the necks wide open or in the shirt sleeves, or we always had to wear jackets. They wore different types of shoes, you know, and slippers, stuff like this, whereas we had to wear black shoes polished. You had to be, you could recognise a soldier, but you couldn't recognise the others because they had a different mode of dress.
When you said you weren't going to let them have your women, what exactly did you mean by that?
Well, we owned Singapore. We were the Mantis Regiment. And we'd been in battle. We'd fought. We were big men. We were the powers that be because of what we'd been through in Palestine. We thought we was God's gift. You know, and anybody coming to Singapore was either coming to drink our beer or steal our women.
Who were your women, though, exactly?
We haven't got any. It was just anybody in Singapore with ours. We owned Singapore, and that's what we thought. But the worst was yet to come, actually, when the Aussies arrived, and that was in 1939 after the war started. God, there was more fights per square mile. And stop, Mick. We hated them, and they hated us. Still do, as a matter of fact.
You mean they hated the Manchesters?
They hated the British. They hated the English, and we hated them. Singapore was a cauldron of men who hated each other. We could never have won a war in Singapore and Malaya just on that fact alone. We couldn't cooperate. The Aussies had their way of doing things, which was casual. The officers, they called Jack or Tom or Dick, whereas we were saluted ours and stood to attention. You got the Chinese, who was in the Malay States Volunteers or Federated Volunteers or Singapore Volunteers. They were in one or the other. They were a different kettle of fish again. Then we had the Indians, the Punjabs and the Sikhs. Again, you've got two different, you know, sections. There was no way it could ever blend. No way at all. The only party that blended there was the Gurkhas. The Gurkhas would just about blend with anybody. They used to go out with you for a drink. They didn't speak much English then, very little. So they just kept their mouths shut. And they watched and they listened and they smiled. You know, they never got into arguments and they got along with everybody. But with the others, they could speak your language, so you got into trouble. Of the British regiments that was there, I mean, there's a lot of words been put into history about the British had lost the empire and all this and the other. Okay, the Brits, if you include in Britain, Australians, Chinese, Malays, Indians, if you're calling that British, yes. But if you're referring to English soldiers, then during the war in the Far East, the maximum British soldiers that were there would be about 20,000. All the rest were outsiders.
How did you get on with the white civilians in Singapore?
We didn't. We hated them, and they hated us. We were dirt, really dirt. Even though not only the white civilians, but our own officers and NCOs that were married, their wives came out there, and they were instantly, as soon as they got there, they got a servant. If they had children, they got two servants. They got all the furniture supplied. They got a family allowance. You know, everything. And at one time, nearly all the time up to the war, if you was going into town, we'll say, and you always made sure there's a gang of four or five so as to share the taxi, made it cheaper. Taxis used to go off at around about 1 o'clock in the morning. The taxis used to stop. The Dantas still went on. Singapore still went on. But you could get a rickshaw, but they would very rarely take you from town to your barracks. So you'd get the odd taxi driver that would run a night shift. Now, if you stood in the middle of Singapore, you'd pass it till midnight. And it's now, 5 minutes to midnight, and a taxi comes along. with a married family in it, an NCO and his wife, or it could be an operator and his wife, they would see you waiting for a taxi, but they wouldn't pick you up. Even though it would help to pay their fare, they wouldn't pick you up because you was dirt. I mean, some of these women that were out there in our own regiments, before the war, they'd been what we called regimental followers. You know, they'd gone with the regiment to different places. They were never married to any particular man, or they'd marry one man, he'd die or divorce, and then he'd marry another one, and so on and so on. But in England, they were just bloody washerwomen. Out there, they were ladies. And it was a hell of a bone of contention, that, with the men. So, unless it was that you were on duty at the swimming baths or somewhere like that, and they wanted to get in, and then, okay, you were their friend, they would smile at you and give you a peck on the cheek or something like that. But once you were outside in the open, no. Then you were, again, you were Tommy. You was dirt. And even the well-off Indians and people like that used to spit down on us. But the old man, Eb Holmes, he was a character.
What was his name?
Eb Holmes. E.B. Holmes. I don't know what his name was. It was E.B. was his initials, and we all called him Eb, and he knew it. But we wasn't allowed to say it in front of his face. He was the one that took the can back for Singapore. For Selarang Barracks. So he was the one that took the can back for that.
This is the Selarang Square incident.
Well, he was in charge of that. Later. Yeah. Well, Eb Holmes was a 100% soldier. And he was 100% English soldier. And his instructions were to us, whenever you go outside and leave this barracks, remember you're a soldier. Remember you're an English soldier. And if you happen to be walking along the street and a Chinese coming towards you, or a Malay, or an Indian, you tell him to get off the pavement. And don't ever step off the pavement to allow him to pass. And that's the way it was in Singapore. That nobody, if you're walking, even though they looked down on you and you were a dirty old squaddy, they had to get off. You know, didn't matter who they were, you pushed them off. And when you're pushing them down a monsoon drain, which is 6 foot deep, they think twice. Usually they jump off anyway. And that's where it was in Singapore in 1938. We were the master race. You know, whatever we said, that went. I've seen one or two punch up to one thing or another caused by it. I mean, we had King's Birthday Parade, which happened, I think it was every 6th of June. And beat and retreat on the Padang, various other things. But the thing, the day would go all right, but as soon as you started marching back to barracks, somebody would start throwing bottles or bricks or stones at you. And one particular one, I remember, the heavens opened. It just flooded. I can't think what the parade was for, but every soldier on the island was on parade that day. And the heavens opened, and the monsoon drains were absolutely full, really full, and flooding. And as we started marching back, the parade was cancelled, and we started marching back. They let us out with everything they could find, bricks, mud, you know, throwing at us. I've seen one bloke going down the monsoon drain, you know, trying to swim his way out of it. But they hated us. They definitely hated us. But when the war came, of course, then it was a different thing then. We was good lads.
Can we come on to the outbreak of war, the Pacific War? And can you tell me what happened as far as you were concerned from the Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor?
Well, when the war started, when it first started in the Far East, it was, what was it? Was it the 6th of December, the 8th of December? I've forgotten now. But I'd been in town, come back, and most of the lads had gone to bed. You know, there was no way we was anticipating the Japanese would fight. As far as we was concerned, they were wogs, they were dirt. You know, they hadn't got the guts. Our camp was at 10th Milestone, and it was a machine gun camp, and so surrounding it, every 50 yards was a machine gun post. But we only had 4 machine guns, or 5, because all the others were wrapped up in greaseproof. We had, hundreds of machine guns, but they were wrapped up in greaseproof, because the Japanese might not start. So it's no good cleaning them and getting them ready if they don't start, because we don't have to put them back in grease again. So the camp, all we had was, as I say, was 4 machine guns around the camp of possibly 2 mile perimeter. So this particular night, as I say, we'd been out and we'd had a drink and most of the lads were dozing off. And I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning and we could hear this dull droning noise. But we didn't take much notice of it, because it was coming down, but it was going out to sea type of thing. And then all of a sudden, of course, they dropped the bombs. And as soon as they dropped the bombs, every bugler, every drummer, grabs his bugle and goes out and starts calling, call to arms, which means grab your rifles, bayonets, whatever you can, and get on the perimeter, which is the perimeter of the camp. I've always done that, and I don't know why it is. I knew every call in the British Army, and I could make a man go and stand on that wire. But there were no call to bring him back to stand down. It's a funny thing, that, in the British Army. But this particular time, as I say, the bombs dropped and we went and stood two. We stood two till 7:30. Nothing happened. So a runner was sent round then to tell everybody, that's what they did. They sounded cookhouse. And some men came, some stayed at the posts. And then a runner was sent round to say it was genuine, it was cookouts, and they could go and have a meal. So we all went round and had a meal. And we discussed it then, the war, or the bombs dropping, what it was. Some people said it was a practice. Others said it was the RAF had dropped bombs by mistake. Some had actually said that the Japanese had done it, and then they'd buggered off again. But there was nothing on the radio. And the radio didn't come on until lunchtime. And then they said that the Japanese were at war with Japan. And that they dropped several bombs on Singapore. But the only damage done was... And they had a newspaper, that's right. They had a newspaper out showing it. The only damage done was a watchman was killed outside one of the big stores. They used to sleep in the doorway of the stores, the watchman, on a charpoy. The watchman had been killed in one place and 2 or 3 people had been seriously injured in another place. After the war, we found out there was 150 killed in that one raid. But they didn't tell anybody that. As far as they can say, it wouldn't help morale